first today, the very private life of Grenville Clark. Clark was a buddy of both Presidents Roosevelt, not to mention Supreme Court justices. His grandfather hung with a guy named Lincoln. But he was the most private of men, as Kansas City's Nancy Hill found out as she researched her book, A Very Private Public Citizen, The Life of Grenville Clark. Nancy Hill serves as an administrator at the Diastole Scholar Center, which is associated with UMKC. And Nancy, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Steve, it's my huge pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let me just take a wild guess here, Nancy, that researching this very private man, Grenville Clark, was quite the challenge.
It was phenomenal. It was, I had an in, obviously, or I would never have known about him.
And the in was?
The in was Dr. E. Gray Diamond,
yes.
My boss, my mentor, my idol, you know, and the founder of UMKC School of Medicine. So when I came to Diastole in 2003, already having lived in California for a long time with these sort of left coast hippie granola ideas, I belonged to some peace organizations. He said, I have someone you should know about who was talking about this sort of thing a long time ago.
Huh.
It was his father-in-law, Grenville Clark.
Yeah. What attracted you to him? What made you want to write a book about Grenville Clark?
Several,
a man no one's heard about.
Right. Well, that was part of it, frankly.
Yeah.
It was the fact that no one had heard of him. You know, there have been books written about Lincoln, right?
Lots of books.
About Dr. Diamond, for that matter, you know. And so here was this person that the more I learned, the more he had done across this huge range of fields that no one had ever heard of. And then when I learned that that was deliberate, that he had carefully kept himself out of the limelight, right? That just was so compelling to me in this crazy age we live in, you know,
yeah.
Andy Warhol's 15 Minutes of Fame,
yeah.
You know, all the wacky stuff.
Well, it's such an interesting juxtaposition. He was the most public of men and the most private of men wrapped up in one human being. Why was privacy so important to him, given his stature and his relationships with all these world leaders?
Right. And that's a great question. And it was one that I looked into a lot. And it seems to be like always a combination of things, sure. So, it was his demeanor and the circles that he ran in.
Yeah.
These were people who did not showboat around. They were rich. They were powerful. They didn't need to. That was tacky, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other thing was
a generation when it was truly tacky. People
right.
may not relate to that these days, but
right.
it was a very different time.
It was a very different time. You did not want to be in the press.
I mean,
and so he just very elegantly, quietly. That was part of it. Part of it was noblesse oblige in those times. Another, you know, thing that if you are wealthy, you are expected to give back, and duty was a big deal. You know,
mm-hmm.
And it went beyond military service and military duty, although he was involved in a lot of that. But no, it was the wise men, right?
Yeah.
That amazing 86 book by Isaacson and Thomas.
Right.
He was that guy. You know, these men were born with a call to service and duty.
It was interesting to me that not only did he prefer to be private, Nancy, but he went out of his way and took steps to remain so. It was a methodical kind of approach that he took to ensure that really no one knew who he was.
Right. And that's what to me was so compelling about him. Also, he went a step beyond the wise men because they all took official jobs and contributed to society that way. He, when he was Henry Stimson's private advisor for 4 years in the War Department during World War II, refused to take the nominal dollar a year salary, which was the standard thing at that time, because he would have had to have taken an official position and taken an oath of office. It threw the War Department people into a tizzy. Who is this guy? Can we mm-hmm. show him the secret documents? You know, of course he was shown the documents.
Yeah. So was he a shy, reserved man? If he was sitting in here with us right now, is he the kind of guy who would just be very deferential and just sort of to himself?
Yeah, shy, no. Deferential in a polite way.
Mm-hmm.
He was self-confident. He was a tall, handsome, strong guy.
Yes.
He was connected. He was powerful. He had no self-esteem problems whatsoever. But he was not a guy who was going to slap you on the back and tell you a joke either,
mm-hmm.
or walk up and shake your hand and introduce himself.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't have to. My boss, Dr. Diamond, who knew him, said this was not a guy that you were going to go talk football with.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So Interesting.
We're visiting with Nancy Hill about her new book, A Very Private Public Citizen, The Life of Grenville Clark. Let's turn to what he did, because he did so much, and you've alluded to a little bit of it here, Nancy. He did so much that, in fact, you call him one of the most important Americans that most Americans have never heard of, and I'd never heard of him as a guy who spent a lot of time covering government and politics. He was a man who knew presidents, for sure. Who did he know, and what was his relationship with them like?
So he knew most of the presidents from Theodore Roosevelt forward. Theodore Roosevelt was a family friend. It was Dear Ted, Dear Granny in the correspondence.
They called him Granny. I was going to ask
you.
Oh,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. He was Granny. And Franklin Roosevelt was his so Theodore was a generation older, but they were more alike in certain ways in terms of doing the big action and taking things into their own hands. And they were very they had a really natural fit for each other and were very close. T.R. became sort of a second father to Clark, if you will, because Clark's father was not at all like that. He also knew Franklin Roosevelt well. They were classmates and the same age, and they were less similar characteristically, but were friends and came from the same circles and just knew each other so well.
It's hard to imagine, but Franklin Roosevelt was even a little envious of Grenville Clark.
Oh, and yeah. He
would feel that way. Why, Nancy?
He famously said to a biographer that the greatest disappointment of his life, this is Franklin Roosevelt talking, was when he was passed over for membership in the Porcellian Club at Harvard. And so this is this ultra-exclusive final club at Harvard. It is the poshest of the posh. Grenville Clark was just in, you know, without having to ask. They are so snooty and exclusive. The T.R. Roosevelts, as they call them, the Oyster Bay Roosevelts, qualified.
Yeah.
The Hyde Parks, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
It is.
Another great story in this book is your account of how Grenville Clark met Teddy Roosevelt for the first time. It's the story that opens the book. Teddy Roosevelt is then vice president. William McKinley hasn't been assassinated yet. Tell us this story about the journey that Grenville Clark took to meet T.R. and how he got waylaid for a little bit here.
This is a great story.
It's a great story.
I opened my little library talk with this the other night, which, by the way, was fantastic. And thank you, library. So here is 18-year-old Grenville Clark.
Yeah.
It's commencement day at Harvard. And he has been invited by T.R., who, as you mentioned, they are not close personal friends yet, but Roosevelt is a friend of Clark's father and mother. So Clark and two friends have been invited to Roosevelt's home. Roosevelt is going to introduce them to Major Frank Burnham, a famous scout and Boer War hero.
And Grenville's all lit up about this
idea.
Oh,
for young
so
boys.
Yeah,
this
is
like the most glamorous superhero guy that you could imagine. So they are pumped. Well, but the logistics are tight. They've got to take a trolley from Harvard Square to Boston and catch the midnight train for Long Island. So they do this. Clark's friends have gone in ahead of him. Clark's trolley is stopped right before it gets across the Charles River. There's a big commotion. Passengers are looking over into the river. There's a woman who has jumped over in an apparent suicide attempt. She's struggling in the water. Clark is thinking to himself, my God, I'm going to miss my train. Somebody needs to do something.
As anybody would sort of think maybe at a moment like that. Yeah.
Right. And so nobody's doing anything. He pulls off his jacket, runs around the riverbank, leaps off the
I'm
high
gonna
retaining
anyway, so
I'm
going to
be
late anyway, so I
might
as well
save
this woman's life.
All right, I'm going to
save
the woman, give myself a chance, give her a chance. So he rescues the woman. What he later describes as in a very cold-blooded sort of way, hands her off to the authorities, leaps back on his trolley, makes it to the train in just the nick of
the
time.
The train is pulling away,
oh, yeah.
And he's like running
oh, yeah.
to catch
he
it.
He is sprinting.
Yeah.
This is an action movie sequence, you know, and his friends are on the steps going, Granny, Granny, you know. And so, as he put it, I was soaking wet, so they got out of me what happened. And you can only imagine them telling that story.
Well, there's sort of a kicker to this story that, as good as what you just said is, he meets Teddy Roosevelt, doesn't relate to Theodore Roosevelt what just happened. Granny's friends end up telling the vice president what's going on here, and Theodore Roosevelt is very impressed.
He's so excited. You can just imagine the Rough Rider. I mean, this is his kind of behavior.
His kind of behavior,
right.
Exactly.
And so he is just, you can imagine saying, bully, you know? And he is so impressed that he has the Massachusetts Humanitarian Society award Clark their gold medal, and then he dashes him off a letter, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's something like, my dear Clark, I am so impressed impressed with what I did. I've only just learned about you saving that woman. And it gave me a thrill of pride as a Harvard man and as a friend of your father and mother when I learned of it. Would you please just give me one or two rough details for my pleasure? Yours faithfully, T.R.
What a great letter.
I know, right?
Have you seen that letter? Does it still exist?
Oh, it is on stationery from the Vice President of the United States. This is what makes it such a joy to research these people from this era and to go through those files and to literally see this letterhead, these signatures, these handwritten notes.
I would love to see that sometime.
Oh, boy. Go to Dartmouth.
Yeah.
That's where Clark's papers are, and it is fascinating.
Yeah. Again, we're talking about a life of a man you probably have never heard of before, Grenville Clark, but a Kansas Cityan, Nancy Hill, has sort of resurrected his image and written a new book about Grenville Clark. The book is A Very Private Public Citizen, The Life of Grenville Clark. You know, something else that he did, and this really stood out to me, he stood up for civil liberties and civil rights before that was cool, Nancy. What did he do there, and why did he do it?
I'm so glad you asked. This is one thing I ran out of time to talk about at the library, and it was one of the things that impressed me most about him. So here is this ultra-conservative, ultra-wealthy Republican man who takes on increasingly the Bill of Rights freedoms particularly. He's civil liberties for all Americans, he says, are in danger of being compromised at all times by a distracted public, by encroachments from every other arena. So he fought against teachers' oaths in the 1930s when
which were what?
So with the Red Scare coming in the run-up to World War II, a lot of teachers were being forced to take oaths saying that they have never advocated or taught anything having to do with communism or any other subversive form of government. Now, some of them were written very innocuously, and Clark felt that those were all the worse because teachers were compelled to really sign these. They, as he put it, they were not in an economic position to be heroic.
Yeah.
You know, and then some of them were so specific that they said, and I further will not make any mention of communism. And to Clark, this is ludicrous. He's a lawyer. He's a student of American government.
Right.
How are students supposed to learn about government with no mention of the competing systems? So he was outraged by them, and he fought them hard. He later fought for academic freedom while he was on the Harvard Corporation Board, which was a version of the same thing, and went to battle against a very wealthy alumni who was going to withhold large sums of money unless two left-leaning professors were let go.
Mm-hmm.
Clark would win that battle and strike a big blow for academic freedom. That was a neat chapter. And then he got the very conservative American Bar Association to create a committee. It was called the Committee to Uphold Civil Liberties. Well, it had like eight words, but the point was it was called the ABA Civil Rights Committee. And they went to bat in Supreme Court cases that involved these essential protections. And Clark had really exhorted his conservative fellow lawyers at the Nassau County Bar Association. He said, protection of these rights has been allowed to drift into the hands of the left. That's not okay. He said, a little intolerance in the civil body is as dangerous as a little potassium cyanide to the human body. And it is up to you guys, not the fringe left people, to protect them. So it was fascinating. And they got up this committee. They weighed in on some really famous landmark civil rights cases, Haig versus the CIO. Boss Frank Haig in New Jersey denying the CIO petition.
And civil rights was something that was important to him, too, even before, you know, there wasn't a lot of attention being paid to it then, but it was on his radar screen.
It was very much on his radar screen from the time he would go down to the South as a child and witness the horrible treatment of blacks there. It never left his mind. And he, in the 1950s and 60s, really, at this point, he's retired now, has a little bit more time to focus on this thing. And he supported the Freedom Riders in a big way on their campaign to do the integrated bus rides. He was a big early supporter of the NAACP, contributed $500,000 anonymously, which was the largest contribution they had ever gotten. But even more importantly, helped them organize, helped them, what Jack Greenberg, the president of that organization, said, turn them in from this loose little body into the highly oiled machine of a public interest law firm that it now is?
It's interesting to me. He was a man of great foresight. He foresaw that civil rights would become an issue, civil liberties. And likewise, in 1915, the U.S. was, you know, at that time determined to remain out of World War I, as most of us know. But Clark foresaw that this country was destined to wind up in it. So he worked with a guy with a great Missouri name, General Leonard Wood. There's the base down southeast in Missouri, to establish a training program for officers. And this was before the U.S. even entered the war. What did he do?
That's exactly right. So it was 1914. Clark was a young lawyer. He was an internationalist, though. He had traveled abroad. He, you know, knew international-minded people. And he could not believe that the rest of the country was still clinging to this isolationist position. To him, it was so clear that this war was coming and that by sticking our heads in the sand was not going to solve the problem. We had to go, and that it was a moral imperative to train soldiers. So he and several of his friends gathered, and they decided to do something about it. They formed a committee. That was Clark. It was form a committee, go down and take this issue on. And he did so. Met with Leonard Wood. Leonard Wood was absolutely sympathetic and said, and what we're going to need even more than soldiers is officers. So Clark gets up the Plattsburgh officer training camps. He convinces businessmen, young lawyers, bankers, all of this to go on their own time at their own expense to a 4-week training camp in Plattsburgh, New York, to take weapons drills, to learn army maneuvers and tactics.
It must have been a heck of a sales job at a time when the U.S. wasn't even in the war.
That's exactly
and there was no
right.
sign it was going to happen, because Woodrow Wilson runs in 1916 on a platform of, we ain't getting into the dumb war. We're staying out.
That's exactly it. And boy, did Clark have run-ins with Wilson.
Yeah.
They disagreed on this issue. Although, as the war came nearer and nearer, they collaborated eventually. And Clark worked closely with Wilson's Secretary of War, Newton Baker, on this, who also completely understood the necessity.
Yeah.
So they ended up being allies on it. And I should say, Clark was a strong supporter of Wilson's 14 points and his statesmanship and leadership after that war. He was a strong supporter of the League of Nations, almost alone among his peer group, you know.
And then in the category of history repeats itself, Grenville Clark does something similar in the run-up to World War II.
Right.
20-some years later.
Imagine the sense of deja vu. So here are the now middle-aged Clark and his friends.
Yeah.
They're having a meeting at the Harvard Club, of course, and they're talking about parades and celebrations of a Plattsburgh anniversary. And he's saying, you guys, do you get it? We're right back in the exact same spot in history. Here's the war coming. What are we going to do about it? So they got up a committee.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote the 1940 Selective Service Act, and he pushed it through a very, very reluctant Congress. And that involved this ingenious maneuvering of replacing the sitting Secretary of War, who was an isolationist. And so they instead, through this crazy backroom negotiations through Felix Frankfurter, ended up getting Henry Stimson promoted to Secretary of War, and then Clark serving, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, as Stimson's private advisor throughout the duration of the war.
Yeah, we just have a couple of minutes left, but he did so much more. I just want to mention a couple of things. He's an author of a key economic bill as the country battled its way through the Great Depression. And then, this really stood out to me, 4 years later, he fights President Franklin Roosevelt, his buddy, okay,
yeah,
on his Roosevelt's famous court packing plan, which I'm sure didn't please FDR very much. Why did he do that? What was he thinking? He goes against his buddy, the president.
That's exactly right. And not only that, Steve, he went against his buddy, the president, knowing that it would foreclose any possibility of his being appointed to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
This was his big chance. And of all the public jobs that he routinely turned down, that would have been the one, the lifetime appointment that he would have relished and been great at. But principle, it was all about principle with Clark. He agreed with Roosevelt that these obstructionist justices were a problem, that were striking down all this New Deal legislation.
Yeah.
But the method was wrong. You could not jeopardize crucial judicial independence. It was too much of a pillar of our government. So he fought, and he was a large part of the defeat of that plan, which is still written about, as you know, to this day.
Even though he could have been a Supreme Court justice himself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And in fact, Felix Frankfurter, immediately after this episode, was elevated to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Felix Frankfurter, who had been actively advising the president and going along with his plan.
Well, Grenville Clark was buddies with a pope, Supreme Court justices, a British prime minister named Clement Attlee, and a guy named Einstein as well. It's all in Nancy Hill's new book, A Very Private Public Citizen, The Life of Grenville Clark. Interesting story, interesting man. Thanks for your time, Nancy. So good to have you.
Oh, Steve, it's been my great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh.